From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Standing before a Republican Congress, President Obama proposed bold plans for higher education in a State of the Union address. And a new survey from the Association of American Colleges and Universities suggests, yet again, that employers have real concerns about the job preparation of college graduates. Hi, I'm Casey Green. I'm the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So welcome all. And ahead of our conversation, please note you can post your thoughts about these discussions on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. In our opening segment today, we're going to talk about higher education and the fourth quarter of the Obama presidency. President Obama's State of the Union address this week formally launched what he has called the fourth and final quarter of his presidency. Confronting a Congress firmly controlled by the opposition party, Mr. Obama proclaimed his support for, quote, middle-class economics and a number of key policy initiatives, including higher education. His big proposals for higher ed include the previously announced plan for free tuition for community colleges, simplifying the FAFSA form, providing new tax credits for college students, and new efforts to address the rising burden of educational loans borne by many students. Conspicuously absent from his State of the Union speech this year were the past comments about the need to stem rising college costs and the need to address institutional accountability and quality via a rating plan, the outline of which went public in December. While the president's proposals were praised by many in the higher education community and elsewhere, some comment that much, if not most, of the president's higher ed agenda may be, quote, dead on arrival when presented to the Republican-controlled House and Senate. Two, many observers, both on and beyond college campuses, note that because Pell Grants already covered the full cost of tuition for most low-income students in community colleges, the $60 billion the president wants to allocate to underwrite free tuition in community colleges might better be spent on academic support services and other higher education initiatives. So joining us to talk about the State of the Union address, the fourth quarter of the Obama presidency, and these policy initiatives are Sandy Baum, a senior fellow at the Urban Institute and a research professor at the George Washington University Graduate School of Education and Human Development. With us also is Jennifer Wang, the policy director of Young Invincibles, and Scott Jasek, the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Welcome to you all. Let's begin with free tuition in community colleges. Sandy Baum, what's not to like about this proposal? And also, given the early opposition from some key Republican congressional leaders on both policy and cost issues, what are the realistic prospects for this initiative over the next 2 years? Sandy Baum?
Well, I think this is a good conversation for us to be having, whether or not there's any chance of it actually being implemented in the short term. And the reality is that this is not a detailed proposal, so it's not something that could be implemented immediately. What's important about this is that the president is paying attention to the funding of public higher education and saying we need more federal and state money. Also that we need a simple message for students, because even though community college is tuition-free for most low-income students now, they don't know that it will be, and that message is important. That said, the details are terrifically important. I think there are a lot of problems with this proposal. As you said, the tuition issue is very important. The barrier to community college is really not the tuition. We're getting a lot of people in the door. They have trouble meeting their living expenses, and they have all kinds of other problems that cause them not to complete. And there's no point getting more people in the door if they're not going to have success. There's also concern about the differential treatment of two-year and four-year colleges. Why do we want everyone, especially all low-income students, to go to community colleges? So there are a lot of issues with this. One thing that's very important about it as a plus is that it does appear to propose putting this on top of Pell Grants. So even though tuition-free is something that low-income students also already enjoy, they would get to keep their Pell Grants and pay for living expenses. That's not the case in the Tennessee plan, so this is not really modeled on the Tennessee plan.
Jennifer Wong from Young Invincibles, what's not to like? Sandy's talked a lot about both the positive side and some of the problems with this proposal. It's, as you and your colleagues at Young Invincibles look at the community college proposal, what do you see?
Absolutely. Thank you so much. At Young Invincibles, we're a millennial think tank and advocacy organization. You know, 42% of all undergraduate students go to two-year institutions, and 30% of all high school graduates go to community college. And yet, we've seen community college tuition go up 25% since the Great Recession. So we're actually very pleased with the president's free community college tuition announcement. You know, Sandy hit the nail on the head. We like that it's a first dollar plan, allowing students to use Pell and other federal aid to cover the cost of attendance, which would include textbooks and living expenses. And I agree with Sandy, you know, tuition is not a lot of these students' main concern. It's often cheaper than the cost of living. And so we really like that the plan addresses the cost of attendance. We have a fellow here, Eric, at Young Invincibles, who benefited from free community college tuition. He was about to start at a four-year institution, was even there for orientation week when his father lost his job. And thankfully, New York State allowed him to attend community college for free because he was in the top 10% of his class and his financial circumstances sustained. He told us that if it weren't for the free tuition he received, he would have had to drop out and work full-time to make ends meet. And we just think that responsible students like Eric deserve a chance to succeed in college. And given how many students are already going to these institutions, we really like that this proposal keeps the conversation going about access and affordability. But I'd have to agree with Sandy that we are also very concerned with completion. We'd like to see something on completion, too.
And Scott Jasek, what does this mean in terms of, you know, Sandy and Jennifer both talked about the issue of support, or sort of the other issue about living costs. That seems to be the biggest barrier for many students at community colleges, not, as both indicated, the cost of tuition. How will this play out?
I actually would look at this less on some of the details and more on the big picture. What President Obama did is he got through to the public that this is a big deal. A lot of other things he's done, most students don't know about the Obama ratings, however much we may debate them in higher education. This seems to have resonated with people, both because it's of its simplicity, free is a very simple concept, and because it puts the attention on the issue of we need more people in higher ed. None of this is to negate any of the criticisms made about the specifics, but what I think is significant here is he's got a discussion going about the students who aren't going to college but should, the students who are struggling to stay in college, and as you said, it could be as much about living expenses as about tuition, and he's got people debating this. He's got Republicans who oppose it talking about how much they love Pell Grants, when I didn't hear them talking about how much they love Pell Grants a year ago. That says to me he's captured attention, and that could go in any number of directions.
But Scott, what about the both on-campus and off-campus criticism, even coming from David Brooks' comments from the New York Times, that given that many students already get the equivalent of free tuition, the money might be better spent on support services and enhancing academic programs at two-year colleges?
Well, I think a big part of the target here is the students who aren't going to college at all. Now, they will need academic support services, too. I don't think this should be viewed as a be-all and end-all. They've got to do much more with the students once they get there. But I don't think all the people focusing on the imperfections of the plan, and one could come up with a long list, are necessarily seeing what I think may really be going on here, which is getting a big discussion going about why students don't go.
And Sandy, the devil's in the details, but is $60 billion to do the tuition supplements and to fill the tuition gap an effective way to spend that money, or where would you suggest it go?
Well, the first thing is that I'm not quite sure how they got to $60 billion over 10 years, but $6 billion a year is not going to cover tuition and fees for all the community college students. And I think that, you know, in fact, one of the problems is that they're, as they should, they need to have some quality control. What about the institutions? Are they adequately preparing students? What about the students? Are they making progress? And in the end, it seems like they're really not talking about free for everyone. They're talking about 2 years free for, I don't know, maybe half of the students. So that is worrisome. I think that the students do need more money. It's very different across states. It's $1,400 a year to go full-time to a community college in California, $7,300 in Vermont. So, you know, talking about it in the nation as a whole is a problem. But I really do think that what students need is better. Community colleges are under-resourced, so are broad-access four-year public institutions under-resourced, and we need to make sure that those institutions have enough resources to really help students succeed so that they get, I mean, even if they don't pay tuition, they are giving their time and their energy and sacrificing labor force earnings in order to go to college. We need to make that worthwhile for them. That's terrifically important.
And Jennifer, let's talk about the issue of eligibility that Sandy and Scott have raised. While the banner headlines may be about free tuition, it's still not clear who might be eligible. The broad outlines of the program as initially announced talked about students who would be making progress towards general education credits over 3 years or a vocational certificate. Didn't say anything about the large numbers of students in community colleges of all ages who need developmental work that would not get college credit. How will this play out, or how should it play out?
You know, we are certainly looking forward to those details, just like everyone else. But I do think that this is a good conversation starter, and Sandy touched on this. There has been a disturbing trend of state disinvestment across the country, and you all bring up very fair points. We need a real investment in higher education because of how much states have disinvested from public institutions, including community colleges and four-year publics. And this raises a question. How are we actually going to incentivize states to put more dollars on the table for students and families, Congress to put more dollars on the table for students and families? You know, I think that these are all fair questions. We would, quite frankly, like to see greater investments in higher education.
I want to touch briefly on tax credits. And Sandy, this is an area of your special expertise. The president has proposed tax credits for students, but concurrently, as we saw in today's New York Times, the proposal also would tax 529 plans for many students. Quickly, sort of what's the trade-off on some of this?
Well, I mean, I think that there's pretty broad consensus about, from people looking at the tax credits and their effectiveness, the tax credits are not the best way to help people get to college. They don't have much impact. If we're going to keep the tax credits like the American Opportunity Tax Credits, certainly the president's proposal to consolidate, get rid of the deduction, make it one tax credit is a really good idea. And to make the refundable component so that it can help more low-income students, to make that component larger, that's a good idea. The 529 plan, I mean, look, people are opposed to anything that takes money out of the pockets of anybody going to college. But the reality is that 529 plans, you can save a lot of money in those accounts. They grow tax-free. You take the money out tax-free. Who saves a lot of money in those accounts? People who have a lot of money who would be saving anyway elsewhere primarily. So really, doing away with the tax-exempt status of 529 account withdrawals is something that is taking money from people who like having the money but don't really need it, doesn't really change behavior, and if we could put that money more into helping low and moderate income students, that would be an improvement.
Jennifer, let's talk about the issue of student loans. Ever since we learned recently that student loan debt has surpassed consumer credit card debt, we've heard concerned voices from within higher education, Congress, and elsewhere talk about the need to address the student loan crisis, with an emphasis on crisis. Although the proposals are still sketchy, are the president's proposals, at least what we know about them, viable? Who will they help?
Yeah, these proposals, for example, his proposal to expand pay as you earn to more people, some are saying all people, is something that we hear about all the time. The young people that we talk to directly day in, day out on the ground are having trouble, quite frankly, paying back their student loans. We know that it's probably having an impact on the economy. Young people can't buy homes. They can't buy cars. A lot of people are unemployed, underemployed. We saw, you know, that young people are moving back in with their parents. It's a new thing that's happening. We're concerned that some of this could be due to folks having trouble paying back their student loans. So we know that there's support for pay as you earn, particularly the expansion to cap monthly payments at 10%. And student debt is a pocketbook issue, but challenges surrounding student loan repayment are so common that we hope that this upcoming negotiated rulemaking on the pay-as-you-earn expansion goes well, because young people are certainly looking.
And Scott, as the journalist, as the official observer, what's your take about the loan proposals and where these proposals will go?
Well, I was most struck by the fact that this week Governor Cuomo in New York proposed a student loan forgiveness thing that tacks on to pay as you earn. And he thinks it will encourage more students to use pay as you earn, and then New York State would offer more. And to me, what was significant there is that the debt problem is so large and involves so many players that I suspect it's going to take multiple players, federal, state, institutional, families and saving to change things. And so I wonder if that may be a sign of willingness of states to, you know, step up too. I think the student loan debt issue is one that has potential cross party lines. And so might be something that could go forward. Even if some parts of what President Obama said on taxes are going to be non-starters for most Republicans.
Another one of the president's priorities is reducing and simplifying FAFSA. This is not unique to the Obama administration. For example, following the release of the 2006 Spelling Commission report on higher education, and again in fall 2008 in the closing weeks of the Bush administration, then Education Secretary Margaret Spellings proclaimed the importance of reducing the FAFSA form from more than 100 questions to just 26. As I recall, there was a photo op where she held up a single piece of paper and said, "This is what FAFSA should be. How do we get there?" Yet 7 years later, FAFSA remains long and complex and still has more than 100 questions. Sandy Baum, what stalled the progress on FAFSA? Why does this remain complex, long, and a barrier for many students?
Well, before I comment on that, let me just say a word about the student loan issue, which is that I think that the idea, if we could get everyone into an income-sensitive repayment plan, that would be terrific, because no one should be having to make payments on their student loans that are unaffordable. That said, if we're not careful, we will make this so expensive that it will crash. We have to be careful that we limit how much students can borrow and that we target the subsidies. So it's not really whether it's 10% or 15% of your income that matters. It's that you not have to make unaffordable payments. In terms of the FAFSA, I think FAFSA simplification is one of the most important things we can do. It's a real barrier to access. There is bipartisan support. And the current bill from Lamar Alexander and from Senator Bennett from Colorado is a great one. We could use the information that we get on tax forms rather than having people fill out a separate form. I think one of the sources of opposition is that people are worried that it will cause states and institutions to then ask for extra information. There are ways around that, but the policy has to be designed to limit the extent to which other sources do make life more complicated for students.
And Scott, you're the institutional memory on some of these things, given your long work in this area. Why has it taken 7 years to bring this back, and why is the FAFSA reform initiative stalled?
I think it's because people worry about the information they may not get. My prediction would be that FAFSA will be simplified. I'll also predict that some point in the future, 5 years or whatever, there'll be news articles in various places about some new way that wealthier people are qualifying for aid they don't deserve. And then people say, well, we need to check X or Y. So everyone likes simplicity, but then after you get simple, everyone starts to identify problems with simplicity. There's no doubt a happy medium, perhaps using the tax forms, but people don't want to give out aid to those who they don't feel deserve it. At the same time, they don't want people confused.
All right, so let's talk about the final part of this, which is the movement of cup to lip, the posturing and the pronouncements as opposed to the movement of public policy. The devil remains in the details for many of these initiatives. The president confronts a strongly a Republican Congress that which has expressed strong opposition to almost any of his proposals and some opposition to the higher education proposals. What's the likelihood of cup to lip on these initiatives? Jennifer, let's begin with you.
You know, I certainly think that in Congress and in the administration, there is an appetite for FAFSA simplification. The hearings all throughout 2014 in both the Education and Workforce Committee and the Health Committee did have an emphasis on simplification. So I think that there could be bipartisan support for things like simplifying the FAFTA. We know there's a bill in Congress. We also know that some folks are paying more attention to making student loan repayment easier and simpler. I also think that some of these proposals have potential at the state level. Just as Tennessee had a free community college program and other states are now examining the viability of creating such programs, probably because the president is talking about them. You know, I also think that there could be an appetite for tax reform. We hope members of Congress have students in mind when this comes up. For instance, we know, as Sandy mentioned, tax credits have not been well targeted, leaving many low-income students and families unaware of them. We'd like to see better targeting if tax reform comes up.
And Sandy, what are the prospects of moving pronouncement and proclamations to policy?
Well, I mean, I think there is a promise for simplifying the FAFSA and actually for broadening and improving the income-based repayment plans. I don't think that there's any chance that we're going to have, you know, this free community college tuition next year. But that doesn't mean, I mean, this is the kind of idea that has to be discussed for a long time, that needs a lot of thought going into the details. It's right to put it on the table and to get the conversation going in a direction which is, how can we improve the system of college funding in the United States? This is not the right answer, this proposal. It's not exactly the right answer, but it's the right starting point for a conversation. So I think it's constructive in that sense.
And Scott Jasek, given the president's proposals, given that the Higher Education Act is up for renewal, what will you be watching over the next year?
Well, I think something that's really key about this twist in the discussion, free community college and so forth, is that it is putting the attention on the least advantaged potential students. A lot of the college cost discussion historically is, how do we help middle-class students afford expensive private colleges? Obviously, that's a real problem for many families, too. But the emphasis on community colleges, even if it could be made in better ways, is putting an emphasis on low-income students, on students who aren't going to college, and some of the Republican critique of it is also raising issues about income inequality and how education plays a role in narrowing income inequality. And so if that goes forward, I think that could be significant.
Great. Sandy Baum, Jennifer Wang, and Scott Jasek, thank you for an informative conversation about the president's proposals in the State of the Union address. In our second segment today, we'll talk about college graduates and ask, how well prepared are they for the world of work? A new report issued this week by the Association of American Colleges and Universities reveals a significant gap between the way that graduating students assess the skills they bring to prospective employers and how employers view the job skills of the students they interview and sometimes hire. Echoing the results of past AACU surveys of employers, the new report, based on a national survey of 400 firms where a fourth of the new hires have either an associate or bachelor's degree, says, quote, when it comes to the types of skills and knowledge that employers feel are most important to workplace success, large majorities of employers do not feel that recent college graduates are well prepared. This is particularly the case for applying knowledge and skills in real-world settings, critical thinking skills, the written and oral communication skills, areas in which fewer than 3 of 10 employers think that recent graduates are well prepared, end quote. This year, AACU also surveyed 613 students for their self-assessment on the same 17 key skills reviewed by employers. Perhaps not surprisingly, the students as a group were often 2 or 3 times more likely than employers to rate themselves as well prepared on these metrics. Some examples: 62% of the students said they were well prepared on ethical judgment and decision making, compared to 30% of the employers. 66% of the surveyed students report being well prepared on critical and analytical thinking, compared to just 26% of the employers. And 55% of the students thought they were well prepared for working with people from different cultures, compared to just 18% of the employers. The AACU report will serve as fuel for those college trustees and elected officials who continue to complain that higher education is not doing an effective job of preparing students for an increasingly complex labor market and the increasingly competitive world of work. And the employer assessments in the AACU report stand in stark contrast to new data from a national survey of provosts conducted by Gallup for Inside Higher Ed, which reveals that more than half of chief academic officers, 53%, rate their institutions as, quote, very effective in preparing their students for the world of work after graduation. Joining us for this conversation are Deborah Humphreys, Vice President for Policy and Public Engagement at the Association of American Colleges and Universities, and Scott Jasek, the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. So, Deborah Humphreys, let me begin with you. This gap between employers, provosts, and students on the assessment of preparation for work. Employers to continue to report that college graduates as a group are not well prepared, even as provosts and students think otherwise. Why the gap? Are students and provosts myopic, or do employers have unrealistic expectations?
Well, not surprisingly, I'm going to say, well, perhaps a little of both. I think that the gap is not actually completely surprising. And I think the most important thing that we have learned, not only from this survey, but from a lot of focus groups we've done and a lot of analysis of the overall economic environment we're in, is to say that this isn't about a situation where higher education was doing great, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, and everybody was getting everything they need, and now they're not. I think what we're really seeing instead is just an increasing ratcheting up of the demands of a very competitive, innovation-driven global economy. And so the employers, maybe they do have unrealistic expectations, but they're reflecting a real urgent talent shortfall, and they're really trying to get more college graduates into the workforce at higher levels of learning. I don't think it's at all surprising that when we interview students who are very near graduation and we ask them, you know, how prepared you feel, they're going to say they feel more prepared than perhaps the employers think they are. That's not that surprising. What I do want to say, however, is that in this survey, we found something that was surprising to me, which was that unlike in earlier focus groups we did some 10 years ago, when we asked what are the most important things for you to be developing, to be ready for success, employers and students were absolutely on the same page on the most important outcomes, the written and oral communication skills, the teamwork skills, the ethical decision making, the critical thinking, and the ability to apply knowledge in real world settings. We tested about 17 outcomes, and what you found was absolute consistency in the ones that rise to the top. Now, clearly, we have a long way to go to actually get all students to the levels that the employers want, but it is actually something interesting that the students do seem to understand that these broad cross-cutting capacities are incredibly important.
So, Scott Jasek, it may be that students and employers agree about the skills, but the results of the AACU survey are not unique. We see this lament in lots of different ways from employers. You know, there's anecdotal evidence, there's other surveys. Have campus leaders and faculty responded to these concerns? I mean, and it speaks to the larger issues of educational outcomes.
Well, I think a lot of campus leaders think they've been trying to respond, but I just know from the discussions I had at the AACNU meeting yesterday and this morning, these results scared a lot of people. And particularly I'm hearing fear about these results from liberal arts colleges, because while liberal arts colleges have been saying, as you know, some governors have said, if not majoring in cybersecurity, what, you know, there's no point. And liberal arts colleges have been saying, you know what, there is a point, and our graduates have critical thinking skills and communication skills that will help them in a range of careers. So if that's your argument you've been making, it is quite alarming to be told employers don't think you're doing well in the areas that you say are your strength. Now, this study was not unique to liberal arts colleges and includes a range of institutions, but the perception that recent graduates aren't strong in these areas, I heard a lot of concern about this, and a lot of people were, wanting to dig in deeper to these issues as a result.
Deborah, let me pick up on a point that you made earlier, and that is the impact of the Great Recession. So employment data indicate that we seem to be recovering from the recession, and job prospects for new graduates are improving. More firms are coming back to campus to hire more graduates. Yet during the recession, we saw governors in some states complain that public institutions were not properly preparing students for employment opportunities. We saw other critiques targeting liberal arts colleges. Were these statements valid for public policy and institutional policy, or were they largely a matter of posturing? And what were they useful at all?
I think a lot of the pronouncements were a lot of posturing. I mean, I think that the thing to, as you focus on the current economic downturn, it's important to put it in the context of what is, in fact, a much bigger structural trend and economic trend line that does have to do with a fairly dramatic shift in the skills and knowledge that people need to be effective workers in a really competitive economy. And so I tend to think of it more in a broader swath. And I would like to go back to what Scott said about this inducing some fear. I think that some of that is good. I mean, some of it is we do have to raise our game. We have to up our game. But I also think that I'm much more of a glass half full kind of person, precisely because I work with so many colleges and universities that I think actually are upping their game and are really focused on re-engineering the curricular pathways that students take to ensure that they do have these outcomes. So I'm more optimistic than pessimistic. The other finding in the survey that I think should actually give our members hope is that a lot of the practices that our members are trying to scale up, things like getting more students to do more applied learning projects, more internships, more undergraduate research, are also the practices that employers say are the kinds of things they want to see in college graduates. The other thing to say is that this is a broad national survey, and we're asking employers to evaluate in the abstract the recent graduates we've created. And I will say that you have to look at the question of scale. I personally think that our current colleges and universities, their best students are just phenomenally good and have extremely high levels of these capacities. We know how to do this. It's a question of whether we can bring it to the scale we need for the demands of today's economy. And it is it's a tall order.
So let's actually look at some of the efforts on the part of campuses. I mean, there is the question of academic content versus other skills. Many of the 17 employment metrics from the AACU survey, including communication skills, creative thinking, analytic skills, ethical judgment and decision making, working with people from other cultures, don't reflect in one sense traditional academic courses or competencies. Certainly it's the case that many institutions have tried to do this. We've had a decades-long conversation about teamwork that began in business schools in the late 1970s and trickled in graduate programs and trickled into the undergraduate program. We've had a long conversation in higher education about critical thinking. Yes, these skills are understandably viewed as part of the desired outcomes of a college experience across all sectors of higher education and within disciplines and majors. How are colleges and universities reviewing and revising the curricula? Deborah, let me take this back to you. What are they actually doing to try to foster these skills, not just for the best students, but for all students, to use your point?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, taking another sort of broad view of a big transition we're in, what we hear from employers all the time is statements which I do think sort of scare people a little bit, but we've worked, for instance, with the LA Chamber of Commerce, and there's a gentleman there, David Rattray, who said to us recently, you know, employers increasingly actually care a lot less about specific skills and knowledge, or what he called static knowledge, because what they actually need are students and graduates who can keep learning over time. So this question of how do we build the capacity of students to take the knowledge they know and put it into use and then acquire new knowledge over time represents a fairly significant shift in what the academy thinks of as its job, right? We have moved from a situation where we were the holders of content, and our job was to deliver that content, to a much broader sense that what we're trying to do is build the capacity of students to keep learning over time. But I think it's very important to say that while these skills seem sort of content-less, you can't develop any of them without real engagement with knowledge and with content. So to use written communication as an example, you don't become a good writer by writing just in the abstract, right? You learn how to write in a context and about a subject. and Scott can, I'm sure, attest to this. The best reporters are the ones who really know their stuff. They know their beat. They know something about what they're writing. So I think that it is absolutely the case that employers are interested in these broad cross-cutting capacities more than they are specific knowledge areas. But it's only through engagement with knowledge and content that you develop these skills. And I do think that there's lots of wonderful examples of ways in which colleges are taking a hard look at the curricular pathways students are taking and trying to specify how exactly they're demonstrating that they have these capacities at higher levels by engagement with real-world problem solving. I mean, that's how you demonstrate you have these abilities. And there's tons of examples out there of colleges who are trying to make that more the rule than the exception in terms of student pathways through college.
Scott, let's go back to the larger context. These are not new complaints and new laments. Maybe perhaps to Deborah's point, it's a new discovery or a new willingness to acknowledge these concerns. But certainly they've been out there for a long time. And again, colleges have talked about teamwork. It began with MBA programs in the late 1970s and has trickled through undergraduate programs into engineering and other disciplines. There's been a decade-long conversation about critical thinking, about being able to work and understand other cultures. Where is this moving in terms of the institutional response? Is it moving anywhere?
I think it is moving. We have on our website today a story about a session yesterday at ANCNU where Mount Holyoke College officials were talking about a curricular change they made. Now, their curriculum is still a traditional liberal arts curriculum, but they're spending much more time thinking about how internships and summer experiential education relates to the disciplines. So they're not two separate things of study the liberal arts and go out and get your career training, but that they're linked. Other colleges that we've written about have done things like, for instance, instead of having all the work handed in through papers, through term papers, having students do more oral presentations or PowerPoints, things that show how to communicate in different forms. So as Deborah was saying, it's not an either or with substantive content in disciplines, but thinking about it in new ways, linking things together in different ways. There's a lot of activity, but what this survey shows is it hasn't yet changed the views of employers that a lot of graduates are still lacking in this area.
And Scott, as we close, I want to triangulate three data points, two from the AACU report in terms of the perceptions of students and employers, and the third from the survey that you released this week, Inside Higher Ed released this week, a national survey of some 640, I believe, chief academic officers and provosts. Over half said they felt their institutions did a very effective job in preparing their students for the world of work. Again, there seems to be a big disconnect, even as campuses are making the efforts that Deborah described, between the experience and the assessments of employers and the experience and the assessments of students and provosts. Speak to that if you would, because that also speaks to the fear factor that you alluded to earlier.
Well, I mean, it's a theme we see a lot of our surveys and also in this AACU survey. I do worry that many times administrators say to themselves, well, we're spending a lot of time and effort and energy on this issue, so we're doing great stuff. And that's just not always the case. And when the question is, are graduates impressing employers, you sort of have to ask the employers, not just ask your own team. And so it also may be the case that a lot of institutions are starting things that have yet to fully pay off for the graduates or for those who hire their graduates. But this is a tension we see in lots of questions where people on campus think they're doing better than those who are off campus.
And Deborah, the survey data from Inside Higher Ed sort of reflect an attitude that my campus is doing well, the problem's with everybody else?
I don't know. I mean, that's a sort of natural way in which people will respond to these kinds of things, especially in an environment where people are working really, really hard and often with fewer resources. But of course, they believe that they're making progress, and they are making progress. So it's really a matter of how much progress we're making, how quickly, and for how many students. I think the other thing that we have to recognize is that the bar is being raised not only for what each and every graduate needs to know and be able to do, but for the numbers of those that we are trying to educate and graduate at those levels. And so it's a pretty dramatic shift societally. As I said, when I look at what's happening out there, I'm optimistic because it's not that we are just stumped by how to do this. We actually know how to do this. We have wonderful programs. But what Scott alluded to before is really important. There's two things. We often don't provide our best, most high-impact practices to all students. We do only give them to some. So there's a scale question. And then there's an integration question. There's a linkage question. And I do see a lot of really promising work that is ramping up rather quickly to try to say, okay, we have to work much harder at helping students draw connections between the experiences they're having in the classroom, the experiential opportunities we're providing to them, and their ability to talk about and demonstrate that they have these skills as they make that transition from college to career. So it's a big transition we're in, so it's not particularly surprising that you're not going to see the results right away. And the final thing to say is that employers are always going to complain. They're always going to want more. But the truth is that the economic data, it's not like they're saying, well, I'm not getting what I need from college graduates, so I'm going to hire people who don't have a college degree, right? They're still rewarding, massively rewarding people who have college degrees. And in fact, they keep putting more emphasis on hiring people with higher and higher levels of college degrees. And that's because they are getting something from them. They just want more.
Great. Deborah Humphreys from AACU, Scott Jasek from Inside Higher Ed, thank you for the conversation about the job preparation of college graduates. Too, we want to thank Sandy Baum from the Urban Institute and George Washington University and Jennifer Wang from the Young Invincibles for the conversation about the State of the Union speech. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio stream or podcast early afternoon on most Fridays. On the web, we are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. This Week is also available on iTunes. Please share your thoughts about this week with us on the comments section of the webpage. Thank you for joining us.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.